This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We usually tape in the offices of Raider, but today we're taping at my home. But I do want to thank Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, our premier sponsor. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible. Lafayette General has been a leader in telemedicine. With the Health Anywhere app, your family can access quality urgent care at any time without an appointment, all from the comfort of your home. It's the waiting room redefined. Download the app today at lghealthanywhere.com. Our guest today is Dr. David Fisher, a World War II Army veteran, who on October 2, 1945, was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for his extraordinary service in the Pacific Theater, specifically against the enemy in Kobe, Japan. Upon returning from the war, Dr. Fisher attended SLI, where he was co-captain of the track team and captain of the football team. He was inducted into the SLI Athletic Hall of Fame for his athletic prowess. He then served as a coach and teacher at Jennings High and then later at SLI. Well known for his lifelong dedication to education, he and his family are the proprietors of Fisher Early Childhood Education Centers in Lafayette. His late wife, Shirley, originally opened the school in their home in 1961 with seven kindergarten students, and it was the first preschool of its kind in Lafayette. The endeavor took off like wildfire, and the business has been continuously run for the past 59 years. There's so much more to talk about, but Dr. David Fisher, I've been wanting to have you as a guest on the show, and I'm honored to have you share your story with Lafayette. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate those kind words. Thank you.
We kind of met recently through Olivia Savoie, who helped you write your life story, and I was able to read the book that was put together, and I'd like to just start with your early days. You were born in Evangeline,
yes,
Louisiana.
It's not even on the map anymore.
But right. But the first place that an oil well was drilled
was
in Louisiana.
The first location in Louisiana that an oil well was drilled.
Right.
It was a little community, and it was good for a young kid growing up there. Didn't have much to offer, but of course I was born in 1925, so that was the beginning of the Depression years.
Right.
And which affected life,
right,
to kids and well as their parents. So, yes, I was born there and lived there until till I was about 11, 12
right.
years old. My mother passed away at a young age with double pneumonia when I was about 10. And my family all worked for the Gulf Company, mm-hmm. so they ended up kind of my father and all of them sort of followed the work of there. So we ended up moving to Jennings.
The big town of Jennings, right?
Big town, about 8,000 or 9,000 people. Mm-hmm. But it was a good move for me.
Yeah.
Yes.
So your dad and your grandfather, I know, worked for Gulf
yes,
Oil.
Yes, my grandfather worked for them. They kind of originated in the Franklin, Louisiana area. And there were three brothers, and all of us grew up very close to one another in
right.
Jennings.
Right. I read that your mother passed away, as you said, when you were...
I was 10.
10, and she had actually helped fight a fire at the elementary school burned down.
I don't know how much relevancy there is to that, but my family, the little school, they just had a school that went through about the fifth grade, and it burned, and there was no water to put it out, you know, in that little old town.
Right.
And so... I didn't know about this, but some of the members of the family, older members of the family, said that a lot of the townspeople went there to try to douse the flames, and that my mother was one of them, and they thought maybe she died of double pneumonia.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen in today's time, but they thought that was what might have
made her vulnerable.
Accelerated it, but yeah. I'm not sure that that was true. But she did pass away at an early age, but people just didn't deal with those kinds of illnesses then like they do now.
One thing I remember from the book that caught my attention was the salt domes or the wells. You would swim in them. They were just...
That was kind of interesting. It was a good little town to grow up in. The big oil companies weren't even in that town, and it was wildcat. It was just people who were interested in it. They started out in Texas, you know. That was the first. That preceded Louisiana, but they came there, and they were what it was. Those little oil wells there were very shallow, and there was there was a salt dome in Evangeline that only was about 1,800 feet below the surface of the world, and so the oil was trapped under there, and when they drilled through that oil through the salt dome, the oil and water would come out.
Right, right.
And they had to do something with the water, so they built some big earthen tanks way in the back of that little town to collect the water. And so we had to learn to swim there. You couldn't sink, you know.
Right. That's what I was thinking. What a great place. Kind of salty, but, whatever.
Yeah, it was kind of nasty, but it was good for the kids, you know.
Right. So you moved to Jennings, graduated, and World War II was still full blast. So
I was one, you know, I graduated in 1943. I was still just 17 years old. And of course, we declared war on the Japs after the Japanese, and which they bombed Pearl Harbor on the 7th of January of 1941. So I was too young to go into the service, but I was one of the thousands of young high school graduates who, as soon as they got out of high school, were old enough to enlist in the service.
Right.
So I did that when I was barely 18 years old.
And you were, a radio operator on a B-29.
Yeah, I actually enlisted in the Army Aviation Cadet Program, but as did 30 or 40 other young children and kids at that time. But none of us made that. You know, by that time, they had all the pilots and navigators and bombardiers they needed. So they gave us a lot of classification tests, and I guess they decided I could learn how to operate radios on Morse code and all of that stuff. So, so I went to radio school at Scottsville, Illinois. Mm-hmm.
You were based out of Guam.
Well, after I finished radio school, I was placed on a B-29 crew. Uh-huh. And that's when we went to Guam, the B-29s went to Guam.
And I know you had distinguished service and actually awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. You know what really interested me, Dr. Fisher? You were on the last mission that many people didn't know about. Everybody thought the bombs over Hiroshima and
well, you know, we flew traditional missions. Mm-hmm. I've always been a little bit, you know, when you hear B-29, usually 9 out of 10 people think of the atomic bomb, because they did drop 2 atomic bombs, the first one in 6th of August of 45, and the second one on the 9th of August, and the Americans thought that would cause the Japanese to surrender, but they didn't.
Right.
So they scheduled four other missions, and that was on the 15th of August. And when we went on those missions, the Americans were anticipating hearing from the Japanese, but we didn't. So we were to have aborted those missions if they agreed to surrender, but they didn't.
Yeah.
So we completed the missions.
I didn't know anything about that.
It's not very well known. There were 4 targets hit that night, and they were the larger cities by that time had already been crippled. So they probably went to some, you know, smaller cities, not to drop them on civilians, but in those smaller cities they had transportation centers and ball bearing factories and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that was what we did, and when we got through that mission, we were short of fuel. We had to land at Iwo Jima on the way back, and when we were there, that's when we learned that the Japanese had, in fact, agreed to surrender unconditionally.
I have a question about what it looked like. Did you get to see a lot of the destruction from?
Not really. There were two types of missions that we flew. One was a daylight mission, mm-hmm. which was in formation. The planes would fly up individually, but then they'd have to assemble at an island or peninsula and go over the target in force. So it was daylight then, but we were generally flying from higher altitudes. And actually, my location in the airplane, I didn't even have a window to look out of. So I didn't really witness very much of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Of course, at night, the night missions were a lot lower altitude, and they were incendiary missions. Mm-hmm. So you could see the fires, and you could see that.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, several times, we were caught in these lights that were shining up in the sky and would not capture, but focus on an airplane, and they would just light up the inside of that plane.
Right.
I didn't see view much of the damage that was done. You know, we'd drop our bombs and get out of there as quickly as you could.
So you were still so young. You were 20 when the war ended.
Yes, I wasn't even 20.
You weren't 20 yet, you're right.
I got out on the 22nd of November, and my birthday, my 20th mm-hmm. birthday, didn't come until the 12th of December.
Right, but what a good birthday gift to leave the war intact.
I mean, I was pleased to do what I did, but I was equally pleased to get mm-hmm. out of the service and get on with my life.
Yeah. So you came back to Louisiana.
Get back to Louisiana.
And I heard that you you enrolled at SLI. You had to wait, I guess, till the spring semester.
Yeah. You know, at that time they had what they called a V-12 program. They had a lot of young men who were at college and either in the Marines or the Navy, but I was too late to catch the last that semester. So
right.
My first semester there was in spring of 1946.
Mm-hmm. And you hit the ground running, I guess, both academically, but also with sports.
Yeah.
You were very active at SLI.
Yeah. Hit the ground running as far as the lady that ended up being my
That's
wife
what
and
I
mother
read.
Of my family.
You met your wife, and she was precious. What a beautiful
her
woman.
Her last semester there, we graduated the same year, though I didn't mm-hmm. know her. She was from Houma. I was from Lafayette. I'm from Jennings.
Mm-hmm.
But her last semester at college was my first, so we hit it up during that time,
but
chose not to marry until I graduated in 1950. So
I've read that you had not even seen a college football game, and yet you ended up being captain of the team.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was lucky. I was just a kid. My first semester there, I was by that time 20,
mm-hmm.
and my three roommates were all about 26, 27 years old.
They had served in the war also.
Yeah, they had gotten into the service much earlier than mm-hmm. I did, and they just wanted to get their two or three semesters and get on with their lives.
Right.
So it was a different era for sure.
Were most of the men at school, they were on the GI Bill?
They were on the GI Bill, uh-huh. and a lot of them were married and had already started families, mm-hmm. you know. Not all of them, but some of them had.
Yeah.
So they really were looking just mm-hmm. to take those two or three semesters and get their degrees
right.
and go on with their lives.
So the football team, I guess, was older men.
Most of them were older, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I was the youngest. I'm sure I was the youngest. I've been the youngest with everything that I've been. I was the youngest guy on my air crew, and I was the youngest guy on the football team,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah.
I was with a lot of older people in college, for sure.
Did you have a favorite sport? Did you like track, football?
I took them as they came, I guess. I was successful, I guess you'd say, in each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was a sprinter and a hurdler, and I tried out for the Olympics of 1948 and didn't make it. But also in football and track, so that was track, but in football I had success. I was drafted by one or two schools. Mm-hmm. But by that time, I was ready to get on with my life,
yeah.
And I was serious with Shirley, and we had already, but when that draft came, we had already set our wedding mm-hmm. date, and I already accepted a coaching job, so
yeah.
I didn't even entertain that.
I saw the letter, though, from the Baltimore Colts asking
Colts,
you,
yeah.
You know, you were drafted. I guess they didn't call you. They just sent a letter or something.
Well, you know, it was not then what it is now, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it was... pay wasn't very good, you know. I mean, it was.
Right.
It just was a different era, and
right.
So I guess if I had not been serious with Shirley, I might have tried it out.
Yeah.
But I didn't, and I'd already accepted the coaching job, so it just I didn't even
yeah.
entertain that at all.
Even when George Halas contacted
and he was a famous
Chicago
guy from
Bears.
Chicago Bears.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah. So.
Yeah.
So, but I don't regret not having
right.
followed that. I made the right choice,
right.
I think.
I'd like to pause for Discover Lafayette's Past, sponsored by our friends at Raleigh Marketing, a digital marketing agency that can help you with marketing automation, content development, and strategies on how to use social media to turn into a moneymaker for your business. For more information, please visit RaleighMarketing.com. And now the moment. St. John's Cathedral, located at 515 Cathedral Street in downtown Lafayette, was originally called L'Église Saint-Jean de Vermilion, or St. John of Vermilion. Situated on land donated by Jean Mouton, the donation provided that it be named St. John and that it face the courthouse. The current majestic structure is actually the third church situated on that site. St. John's Cathedral is the mother church of the Catholic Diocese of Lafayette, which diocese was founded in 1918 when several Southwest Louisiana parishes were carved out of the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Father William Turlings began planning for the new church when he was named pastor of St. John in 1906. Construction started in 1913, and on June 27, 1916, Auxiliary Bishop Jean Marius Laval blessed the completed church, and not long after, the Church of St. John was elevated to the rank of a cathedral. As an aside, Father Turlings was a beloved priest who rode his horse around to provide comfort and solace to the dying. He later served as pastor of St. Genevieve Church, also in Lafayette. And now, back to our show. So you and Shirley got married in 1950.
Yes, in August of 1950.
Yeah, and then you took the assistant yeah. coaching job at
yeah. Well,
Jimmy's
I started, you know, they hired me during the spring to mm-hmm. put the offense in. And so then our first season was in 1950. So, yeah, and so we lived in Jennings. That's where our family started.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. There was an anecdote in Olivia Savoy's book, and it kind of caught my attention that when you were leaving your wedding to go to your honeymoon, your friends kind of made you pull off the road and get a drink,
yeah,
and you'd
yeah.
never had
Well, no, Shirley
alcohol.
And I neither drank. I wasn't a very wild child, I don't think, at all, in college. And during those days, we were married in the Catholic Church, and you couldn't receive communion until... If you know, you had to wait until after you. We hadn't had a meal in a long time, and then after the wedding,
oh, I see.
we were at the reception mm-hmm. and hadn't eaten anything, and so they got in front of us and tried to stop us and said, "Well, if you let us get buy you a drink, mm-hmm. We'll let you go." So we stopped in Raceland. We were on our way to Biloxi for our honeymoon from Houma. 2 hours away, I guess. And so, yeah, we stopped there, mm-hmm. and the car by that time was all, had signs all over.
Oh, I bet. What a day.
So we rolled around the jog mm-hmm. block and found a car wash and cooled off a little bit while they were cleaning that car.
You know, speaking of all this, I don't want to digress too much, but when you were at SLI, I'm thinking about now how people like to tailgate and you know, there's liquor, there's drinking, and what was it like that
no,
when you were in college
no, it really
after the
wasn't.
War?
We there was a lot of enthusiasm.
I bet, you know, we yeah.
played in McNaspy Stadium, mm-hmm. which was the old stadium mm-hmm. on campus, and it would probably seat maybe 10,000-12,000 people. It was filled.
It was filled.
And they had the Red Jackets at that time, who were the cheerleading group, mm-hmm. you know, and they had cheerleaders. And there was so much enthusiasm mm-hmm. from the students. I miss that even now because, but it was done. Life was different, you know. Mm-hmm. But
it was simpler.
But it was very. There was a lot of enthusiasm with football. You know, we didn't win every game, but I guess people came out and enjoyed what they saw.
And when they attended, they went to watch the game and not just to tailgate.
I didn't know anything about tailgating and all of that kind of stuff. I really don't think it went on hardly at that level anymore.
Right. So you and Shirley moved to Jennings. And you started your family, and I know you have 7 children
we
now.
We have 7. Our first one was, we got married in 50, mm-hmm. and our first daughter was born in 52. Mm-hmm. If you're interested, it was 52, then 55, then 57, 59. My oldest son, David Jr., was the last one born in Jennings. But by that time, I had already accepted a job at SLI mm-hmm. and was driving back and forth. And then we moved here in 1959, and we had 2 more here.
Wow. Well, we're sitting in your home.
3 more.
Yeah.
3 more, yeah.
We're sitting in your home in Lafayette, and it's a beautiful home, but I bet it was pretty crazy in those days,
huh? As I said, for 15 months, I commuted because Shirley by that time was teaching in a little school in Jennings, and so we just didn't see anything. But the city had just, had just started moving south, and a friend of mine lived on this street and saw that there were some for sale signs here. So it was a poorly developed area. I mean, there were dirt yards.
We're way out in South Baton Rouge.
So we ended up buying two lots here.
Uh-huh. And this was a 2 lots?
Yeah, we ended up with 2 lots.
Wow.
And they wouldn't be available this much property now.
Right.
Know? But we moved here before Broadmoor was even. They were just laying the streets out in Broadmoor when we built here.
Mm-hmm. So. You've added on, though. I mean, the house wasn't like this when you moved in, I'm sure, in 1959.
No, you know, we were fortunate. The real estate guy that we bought the property from, his name was Shine Young, and he mm-hmm. He was older than I was, but he was a basketball player here, and he knew me as an athlete when he was from some little old town in North Louisiana, but he was a very prominent real estate man, and he had these 2 lots listed for sale, and he put me in touch with a builder here in town, and so we worked with him, mm-hmm. and I think I have as well built a house as there is in Lafayette.
I would think so. Yeah.
And they don't put them together like this anymore.
I know.
We didn't have but 4 children when I came here. And the school started here, mm-hmm. and it just kept expanding, so we had to add it. So the room that we're in now was the first addition that we had, along with the school was in here, plus the den.
Right.
And then we added, we enclosed our carport to enclose it more. Mm-hmm. So it started out only as a kindergarten.
In
1961. Uh-huh. And then kindergartens were put into the state system. So our numbers diminished a little bit. But then by that time, Shirley and me both appreciated the lower childhood education. Mm-hmm. So we started developing programs for 4-year-old children and even for 3-year-old children.
Right.
So we had to add on to our home. And in 1970, we began expanding, buying property.
For our
regular school.
Off-site.
Yes, ma'am.
If we can back up, you ended up getting your PhD in physical education.
Yeah, it was in physical education, but I had, by that time, I got my master's degree when I was coaching at Jennings in mm-hmm. 1955.
From LSU.
At LSU. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no graduate courses at UL at the time. So I got it in 57. And I figured that'd probably be the end of it for me. But then I realized being on a college faculty, I should get a doctorate. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I had become interested in the development of these young children because I had to step over them in my house for a long time. And so the topic of my dissertation was a relationship that existed between physical and the mental aspects and the development of young children. So
Would you talk about that just for a minute? What were your findings?
Well, there's definitely a relationship. You know, you have to prove everything statistically when you're doing a dissertation, and it's undoubtedly obvious to us that it helped. But statistically, I was unable to do that because we determined, and even the people that were helping me with the dissertation realized that most of the children that we got, when we got them, they came from upper echelon families, or, you know, a lot of oil people moving into town. And so they started out at a higher level. And but it's definitely true. And I have a lot of material that we still use in our schools.
Through this podcast and other things I've done, Dr. Fisher, I've learned about adverse childhood experiences. And I guess it's the opposite of what you were seeing. You were seeing children that probably had advantages. They might have had some heartache at home that you didn't know about. But for the most part, these children were given a good start in life. But there's so many that just
don't. Well, you know, even when I was at USL, the last several years that I was there, we had a program working with special children who either were slow moving along the educational lines or who were physically affected. And so we worked with them. I got students from special ed or education to help me. And we worked with probably every semester we'd have probably maybe 40 or 50 children from the city who, you know, parents had these children who needed extra help.
Right.
So we did a lot of that.
Yeah, that must have been so rewarding to work with those children.
Was, yeah.
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 So you and Shirley, I know you left SLI. Was it USL in 1974? You left to work with the business.
Yeah. You know, Shirley had... I retired early from USL in 74, and I was in a corrosion business for about 6 years, which didn't prove very interesting to me.
No.
And so I sold out of that in 1980, and Shirley had knee surgery, and the school by that time had grown very greatly. So, and I was involved with it even before. So I came and had an office in one of the schools that we had.
Right.
And I did everything. You know, by that time, you know.
Oh, yeah. You're everything from janitor to president.
Because you're up and down. Earlier in the mid-80s, you know, the economy here dropped. So, excuse me. So you just did whatever had to be done, but I enjoyed that, being there, because I had an office, and I was able to meet and associate the parents with the children who were there.
Right.
And that was very meaningful to me.
Right.
You know, in the latter years, that hadn't been happening. I mean, I haven't had an office at the school, but three of my children are active at the school.
Right.
But I miss that closeness and association with the parents of those children.
God. So during the 80s, things really did, the bottom did fall out of, you know, Lafayette's economy. Was that a rough time for your school?
Well, you know, that's why I did janitorial work and all of that for a while. We had, the Fisher School has always worked independently, but we had, starting in the late 1970s, early 80s, we went into a partnership with another couple in town whose name was Gouchereau.
Right.
The lady, Gail Gouchereau, worked for us in one of our schools. So we ended up going into a partnership with them, and we had a school on South College.
Right.
And we also had one on Mall Street. And those schools were doing greatly. We put our program into them because we were more familiar with the learning aspect of it. And we disassociated that partnership when the economy got bad. Mm-hmm. And that school is still one of the locations is still available.
Pass that all the time.
The Gushiro location, one of the South College location, is still operating now. One of the daughters. Both of the adults are deceased, but one of the daughters is still operating that school in South College.
So your locations are Farrell Road.
On Ridge Road.
And Ridge Road.
That was the original one. It was actually the building, the main building we're in was at a lumber yard, which was bought by Holy Cross Church in 65. And so the church was active in that building from 65 to 70. And the priest knew about our operation, and we needed to get this out of the house.
Right, I can't imagine how busy this was.
So we bought that property from Holy Cross Church. Uh-huh. And
your church, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we had to renovate it, and we bought buildings and stuff like that. And then in 73, we had bought property on Farrell Road. And
which was way out also.
Right by Women and Children's Hospital. So I cut the grass for about 25 years there. But we finally, Lindsay, our youngest son, who worked for Lourdes Hospital at the time, wanted to get involved with our school. Mm-hmm. So he kind of ramrodded the work with the architect and all of that. And in 98, we opened the school on Farrell.
I see.
And those are the schools that we operate now.
Yeah. You've been lucky to have your family supporting, your efforts to keep this going. And I want to mention your son, David Fisher Jr., is an optometry, is that right? Yeah. I know his name is well known in the community also.
All of them have worked at the school. And, I think they were affected in a positive manner by being able to rub shoulders in my house before the school was that they could witness the needs of children there were a lot of social and physical interchange with these children, so I think they even profited from that from that experience.
I was sad to read about your wife Shirley's passing. And it was about 5 years ago, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
You were married 64 and a half years.
Yes.
And if I may ask, you guys, not only is that a testament to your love, I'm sure you must have had your challenges raising seven children and having your business in your home. That must have been.
It was a busy place, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
We had help, of course.
But I mean, still.
I think when we constructed this house, the room we're in right now was the first addition we had. And at the time, terrazzo floors were just coming in to homes, And so we had terrazzo. And we kept the additions that we had were terrazzo. So I have solid walls in this house and everything, so you can't punch a hole
wood.
In the wall.
Yeah, it's a beautiful home. Lots of wood.
So we're very fortunate, I guess. But but it was busy, I'll tell you that. It was busy.
Do the years fly by?
I'm sorry?
Do the years fly by? Have they? Or do you look back? And
yeah, they did. We did a lot of things with our children. We I always had a station wagon. Even when the kids were very young, we went on trips there. Whether we could afford it or not, we did. And then for a while, we had a motorhome. When they first came in, it was an old Winnebago, and they were learning how to make them at that time, I think. And so we went all over on that. Usually we'd go west, but we had a lot of very interesting trips.
Did I read that you would put like 15 suitcases on top of the car?
Yeah, 17.
17.
Well, by that time, all of our daughters were older.
Oh, boy, and, shoes.
And I had a station wagon that had a metal rack on it. Mm-hmm. And Jennings, You can get things done in a little town like that. So I had a shoemaker make me a waterproof thing that I put on top of my station wagon. Uh-huh. Well, by that time, all the girls had their own suitcases.
17 suitcases, though. That's a lot of drag on the highway, huh?
Yeah, so, well, and we'd get okay. And I mean, Shirley and I bumped heads a little time with that. Because I'd get there and I'd want to take just the two or three suitcases off.
At night.
Yeah. And she'd say, well, you know, somebody's going to steal them. And she was right.
She probably was right.
So every night, we'd have a little friction there. Having to take all of that stuff off and remember how to put it back on. But it was neat. We enjoyed all of that.
Yeah, those were different days. I remember when I was young in the 60s, I was born in 57, like one of your children. But I remember, you know, there weren't a lot of places to stay. So we'd bring a cooler with lunch meat and bread, and everybody was cool with that. You just had ham and cheese or whatever you had, you know, cheese sandwich and stop on the road.
Well, obviously, when we just had a station wagon, we had the bed down in a motel somewhere along the line.
But the roads were different. We didn't have all the highways.
But when the motorhome came, we usually would make those trips with other friends who also had a motorhome. So it was pretty neat.
Right. So Shirley, gone 5 years. You look, I mean, you're in incredible physical shape. I know you're active. Do you have anything you can share about that, like your secrets?
I don't know. I'm 94. I was born in 1925. And I've just been active all my life,
very
I guess.
Active.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I was an athlete in high school, and in the service, you're still active physically. I was a young kid. And when I went in the phys ed department, physical education department, then I coached on the high school level, and I went back to college and was in the PE department. And I've just been active around my house, I mean, since I've retired.
Yeah.
And the one thing that kind of slows me down, my knees are not what they used to be. I guess none
That's
of us are.
Yeah.
But I've just been active physically, and I guess that's the nature of the thing.
Yeah.
I feel very fortunate.
You are, but I mean, your family's so lucky to have you.
They've been worried with this sickness thing going on. That's one reason why I have one of my daughters who doesn't have a family and not married, and she's been with me for about 3 or 4 months, and she's, I'm not as careful as they are about protecting myself, you know. So she's trying to make sure that I don't
follow the rules.
I haven't had any real serious health problems, but I have had some things that would probably lend itself to developing into something more serious should I get come into contact with that.
Right.
So she's more protective than I am. We don't bump heads on it because I know what I know she's right and I'm wrong about it.
We've been very careful here, though, so thank you for, you know, letting me come to your home.
I think sometimes she's overprotective, but better to be that way than
sorry.
Than absolutely.
Right. Do you have any advice for people, like things you look back on with your life, you know, things that are important when you... You know, with hindsight, do you have any things to share about what's been important to you?
You know, I don't have any second guessing of my life at all. I mean, I'm satisfied. I mean, I think that, I think that we've done what we were put on this earth to do. You know, we married one another. We were attracted to one another. Mm-hmm. We married. We had a family. Proud of them. All of them have done well. So I just, to me, that's, I don't second guess the end of my life at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I've had bumps in the road a little bit, you know, but nothing so much that I question my life at all. I'm satisfied with where I am.
It's so sad when you hear about people that do have regrets because you can't go back. Everybody pretty much tries to do the best they can at the time, you know.
Yeah.
But I love your story. I want to again give tribute to Olivia Savoie. I know you had written a lot of your memoirs, and she helped you pull the book together. It's a beautiful testament to your life, starting with baby pictures and
years. When I started that, doing that was when I left USL or UL mm-hmm. and started at the school, and I had a little office at the school. And it just occurred to me that it might be meaningful for me to record some experiences I had in the Depression and otherwise to share that with my children. So my original thought was just to write it all down and copy it and send, give him mm-hmm. copies of it. And I was eager with it at first, and then sometimes I'd get busy and I'd put it aside for weeks or months at a time, and then I'd always come back to it. And then the longer I'd take to get back to it, the more difficult it was to get my thoughts processed together.
Right.
So and that's when Olivia came into the picture, mm-hmm. and it just ended up being 400,000% more than what I thought it would be.
It was a team effort.
I wasn't even going to have pictures or anything like that. But my wife was a big photographer. She took a lot of pictures, and some of my children knew mm-hmm. where they were, and so they kind of, two or three of them helped mm-hmm. Olivia put that. So her organizing the printed material that I had with the pictures mm-hmm. added greatly to that.
I did notice that in a lot of the pictures, it was you and the children. So your wife Shirley was taking the pictures.
She was a big. Yeah, I was just like one of the kids when we were taking those pictures. Mm-hmm. When we'd be in that station wagon and get out to see something, I wanted to see what to be seen just as much as them. But she had that camera ready to go. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
So we had to be still while she took those pictures.
Right.
So, and I'm thankful for that now.
Was there anything you thought I would ask you that I haven't?
I don't know. I just I think you've covered some pretty interesting and meaningful things to me, and I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I think your life is a testament to one well lived, not only for service to our country, but raising a family, having a wife you loved, helping our educational community. You've done so much, Dr. David Fisher.
Well, in the book, I'm satisfied with my life. Years ago, there's something in this room that we're in now. Somebody from one of the Catholic papers interviewed me years ago, and in 2012. I was honored by the Alumni Association for this spring gala thing. And so my kids wanted to brag on their daddy, I guess.
Well, sure.
So the lady from one of the Catholic publications interviewed me. And I can't turn my head to look at it, but this sign over here on the other side sort of explains my philosophy of life, and that is, I think that Shirley and I were put on the earth to have family, mm-hmm. and I'm pleased with the way all of them have turned out. So, to me, that has been our contribution to the country, to the world.
And there's
whatever.
No greater gift than to have children that you love. Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate you.
Thank you.
I appreciate your questions. Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. David Fisher for joining us today. What a life well lived. And I want to thank our listeners for learning more about the history of Lafayette and also our sponsors. I want to thank Iberia Bank, Lafayette General Health, Raleigh Marketing, and of course, Raider for all that they do to make this podcast possible. In particular, Jason Sikora, thank you for mixing the tape and making this sound professional. Please check out our website at discoverlafayette.net, and we'd love to have you subscribe to the podcast. You can do that on your phone or on our website, but you can have a new podcast delivered every Friday to your phone and enjoy Dr. David Fisher and other people's stories that have made a big contribution to our region. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift. Thank you.